Welcome to Career Conversations. My name is Siobhan Murphy, a careers consultant here in DCU Career Service. We often hear about the future of work and that how we will all have a number of careers in the future. But that future is already here for a huge amount of people already in the workplace. So joining me to explain their career and the number of careers they've had, and in particular to unpack those, I suppose, the anatomy of those career decisions. So joining me is Dr. Martin McAleese, who is currently Chancellor of Dublin City University. So Martin, you're very, very welcome to the show.
Real pleasure to be with you, Siobhan, and good afternoon to all your listeners.
So we're just going to start off. I mentioned in the intro that you're a Chancellor here in DCU. Can you maybe first of all explain what is your role as Chancellor? What does it mean on a day-to-day level?
Well, I suppose, Siobhan, in many ways, the role of Chancellor is akin to the role of Chair in the corporate sense. And the members of governing authority are equivalent to the directors in a corporate sense. The only difference is one of scale, because in a normal corporate setting, a normal corporate board, there might be 7, 8, 9 directors, whereas on the governing authority of DCU, there are 28 members. So there's a difference in scale in terms of numbers. But other than that, the functions are almost the same. And at the heart of those functions, the core work of the governing authority is governance. We do not ever stray across the line into the day-to-day management or the operational function of the university. That is the role of the president and the senior management team, and they report to us on their stewardship of that operation, the day-to-day running of the university. And what we do, we give them strategic direction, we give them strategic thinking, we act as a sounding board effectively for them, but we never cross that line between what is governance and what is the day-to-day. And then, I suppose, by way of background, the governing authority meets 6 times per year. It has a number of subcommittees. The majority of members are external members. The gender balance currently is 54% in favour of females. And we're particularly proud of that because, again, it shows the university's commitment across the board to gender equality. And the term of a governing authority is 5 years. And often we're asked, you know, where these 28 people, I mean, where do they come from? Who chooses them? How are they selected? What are the qualifications? What is the track record? And so it's a mixture of internal and external people. So, for example, the president, the vice president of academic affairs, the chief operation officer, are members of governing authority. There are elected staff members, both from the academic cohort and the non-academic cohort. There are student representatives, both graduate and postgraduate. There's nominees from the educational trusts, from the alumni council. There's a local authority nominee, there are ministerial nominees, and then there are other independent members from a whole range of nominating constituencies. So it's a very diverse body of people, and that diversity goes beyond gender diversity, which, as I mentioned earlier, is very, very important. But more specifically, the role of Chancellor really is to chair the meetings in an open, transparent, professional way, to give everyone a fair hearing, and to seek consensus on the issues that come onto the table. And over the last 10 years, I am very proud to say that not one issue has been put to a vote. Every issue has been resolved on the basis of consensus by unanimous decision. And that's something I'm particularly proud of. Just a couple of other functions of the Chancellor, Siobhan. The Chancellor presides over the graduation ceremonies, and that is one of my greatest joys in this role. I never tire of walking behind the academic procession into the helix with the DCU anthem blaring in the background, and all those young people and not so young graduates all geared out in their best finery, in great form, exuding huge energy, and the parents with that pride and joy on their faces too. I will never tire of that. I come away from that so energized. And I've often said that DCU has always to hold on to that Helix experience, because I think it is its greatest marketing tool. And then just to give another insight, just finally, into a couple of other things that the Chancellor is responsible for. There's a kind of an ambassadorial outward-facing role where the Chancellor is required to promote the university externally, to network on its behalf, and from time to time to get involved in fundraising. So that's a kind of overview of the job, Siobhan. But the important point there is really it is focused entirely on governance. That is our role. And we do not, as I said earlier, ever cross that line between governance and the operational or management role within the university.
Brilliant. And we might actually use this time, that your time in your university now as Chancellor, and then we might bring you completely back to your early beginnings in your own university life, and maybe talk about your first career decision and what you studied at college. Maybe can you unpack all that and what was going on for you at that time in your life?
Well, I grew up in Belfast, Siobhan, and coming to the end of second level, just before A-levels, we got these forms to fill in relation to what we wanted to study at university. It's probably hard to believe in this present day and age that at that time, there was no career advice whatsoever. That sounds almost medieval, but that is the way that it was. I didn't know what a career teacher advisor looked like because I never come across. So we were faced with this daunting task, I suppose, of filling in a form. And I mean, I ended up applying for physics at Queen's. And the reason that I decided on physics was very, very simple. It was because I was good at it, I liked it, and one of my closest friends was going to do physics as well. And that's how it happened. So I ended up spending 3 years doing an honours degree in physics. And coming towards the end of that, I realised this was very restrictive in the sense that there was very little at that time for physics graduates other than to either go into teaching or to stay on and do research by way of a master's or a PhD. And I particularly didn't really want to do either of those two things. And I looked around, I remember in the final year, coming up to my final exams, looking around, looking for, trying to figure out what I was going to do next. And so I decided on accountancy on the basis that I thought the package was quite broad in terms of an exposure to economics, to taxation, to accounts, financial things. And I just decided that that was what I was going to do. And as a result of that, I started with what was then Stokes Kennedy Crowley in Dublin. It was the precursor to what is known today as KPMG. So I started there in September of 1972 and went down that road of becoming an accountant. And I suppose 2 years in Dublin, 2 years in Belfast, and then I spent some time working as a financial controller and company secretary with two Aer Lingus travel subsidiaries. Now, that brings us to the next big change, which was an entirely different kind of a change to the change from physics to accountancy. We were married, myself and Mary were married when we were 24, and so 6 or so years later at 30, we had no children. And I realized that I could probably be doing what I was doing job-wise for the next 40 years,
yes,
maybe with some promotion steps and so forth. But by and large, the work essentially would be the same. And I didn't really buy into that. I thought, you know, there's much more to me than simply continuing this path. And I think that within every one of us, there is an impulse for change. And I think the challenge is, how do we avail of change, and can we avail of change? I often remember Mary saying to me, as a result of one of these reinventions, you know, when you change fundamentally from one thing to another, she said to me, you know, what are you talking about? You haven't changed one little bit. But that's not the type of change that I'm talking about, nor is the kind of change that someone, say, who is an accountant working for PwC, moves over to KPMG, or someone who is a lawyer moving from Matheson's to Arthur Parks, that's not the kind of change that I'm talking about here. I'm talking about a step back and a real fundamental change went off in a completely different direction. I mean, if you're one of those people who gets up early in the morning and looks forward every day to going to work, I envy you, because I think that no matter what we're doing, whether it's brain surgery or stacking shelves in the supermarket, jobs become routine and repetitive. And I think there is a thought process around change. But not every one of us can take the opportunity to change, Siobhan, because many things hold us back. The first thing is the fact that you're putting yourself up to be tested again, and you're not sure if you'll pass that test. You're not sure if you get through it and you finish the course, that you'll actually like what you've decided to change to. And then there are other factors around family, mortgages, financial issues, people depending on you, maybe acting in a role of a carer. And in those circumstances, it is probably irresponsible to make a change like that. But there's always the opportunity to change in retirement. In fact, there is always the opportunity right to the very last day that you breathe breath, that you can change. And I often quote the example of my father when talking about this kind of change. I mean, I grew up in a very traditional family. My father was a breadwinner. That was all he did. My mother did everything else. She was the homemaker. She looked after us as children. She gave up work when the first of her children came along. She did all the cleaning, the shopping, the cooking, you know, everything concerned with the kids in the house. My father did absolutely none of that. And I could have gone through life believing that all my father was capable of was a breadwinner. But what happened just before he retired, my mother died quite early, and eventually, shortly after that, he retired and was living on his own in Belfast. Meanwhile, I was back studying dentistry at Trinity. And a year into that, our first child came along, and we used the crash in Trinity to help us out in terms of childcare. So we would deposit the child in the crash in the morning, and we would take turns going over to change the feed and so forth during the day. But what happened then was that the staff went on strike. We were living in Dunshaughlin at the time. We had no family support. We were effectively blow-ins to Dunshaughlin, and everybody knows what that actually means. Mm-hmm. We had no support. And I remember phoning my father out of desperation, saying to him, look, is there any chance that you can come stay with us for a few days or even a week to help us out of this very, very tough spot that we find ourselves in? And he came and he stayed. And not only did he mind that child, but he got involved with the twins who came along shortly afterwards. We ended up with three children under 2.5. But he washed them, he fed them, he changed them, cleaned the house, he did shopping, and he cooked for us. And it was a real joy for me to know that there was more to my father than being simply a breadwinner. He got the opportunity to explore a lot of talents and indeed reveal a lot of talents and qualities that he had hidden within himself that up until he came to live with us, he had not had the opportunity to put into action. And I would say to all your listeners, Siobhan, whether no matter what age they are, that always remember that there is more to each one of you than the sum of your accomplishments to date. And you can access those additional accomplishments that you're capable of through change and to take the opportunities that come your way. Now, I realize that this is very difficult for some people for all the reasons that I have mentioned. But the impact of change, of that kind of fundamental change, is that it is really rejuvenating, it's energizing, it is so refreshing. And once you find the courage and have the opportunity and the circumstances to make the first change, the second, the third, or the fourth change can come very easily. And I think that within every single one of us, there is so much potential. There are so many hidden qualities and talents and abilities and skills that we actually don't ever live to fully realize just what we are capable of. So vast is what is within us. And it is all about finding new opportunities, changes, going in different directions that we begin the process of really knowing what we're capable of.
Can I just bring you in there? Because what you're saying about change, you know, with bells on, I totally get, you know, but, and as you said, quite rightly, you know, it is hard. Like, we often want the change, but we don't always want the changes that go with the change. You know, it can be kind of,
sure,
can be very challenging from that point of view. But obviously, often motivation will override and, you know, kind of help us on that journey. But just going back, say, you studied physics, and obviously, we're very much believers that, you know, and good education in any discipline opens up your gateway and your minds to turn your hands to anything. And people with a background in physics are very problem solving oriented people, can do kind of people, and kind of work on the solutions rather than get bogged down in not achieving things. But just say when you're looking at accountancy, and then you were saying, oh, really love to be a dentist. Like, what was going on there? Like, you know, did you always have a thing about dentistry? I mean, unfortunately, I'm the type of person who said, I have to psych myself up to go to the dentist, you know. But, you know, so talk to me a little bit about the dentistry. I have to say, I'm just of that generation that, you know, the injections took a while to work and I've had memories, but it's nicer nowadays. But talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, I mean, I think we all have a fear of a dentist, or very many of us have. And I mean, you just mentioned there about your own injections and how slow they were to take effect. But I go back maybe a generation before you, or maybe a lot more than that, Siobhan. And I mean, in the 50s, when I was a young person growing up, I mean, dentistry was much less acceptable than it is now. I mean, the techniques and the ways of doing things have improved so vastly since then. But no, it was a question really of accepting, first of all, that I wanted to change. Two, there was an opportunity because we were two young married couple. We didn't have children. And so we weren't tied. There was a mortgage, okay, and there was commitments, financial commitments. But other than that, we were relatively free. So why dentistry? Well, first of all, when you do make a fundamental change of career at that age, don't forget, I was 30 when I went back to Trinity full-time to study dentistry. You want to make sure that when you invest almost 5 years in a course or a subject, that when you finish and are qualified and working in that area, that you have a decent return on your investment of 5 years financially. And I felt that dentistry provided that security, and that turned out.
So your accountancy stood you in good stead there.
Well, I think it's very
no funny. Education is wasted.
Well, I think that, you know, it would be foolhardy to do something very, you know, despite the merits, something quite intangible or ethereal in terms of a return on the investment. And you can think of many career choices and professions that are in that basket, if you like. But dentistry was the one that I felt was that suited me at that time. And there's a couple of other reasons. First of all, it was in total contrast to what I was doing at that time. Working as an accountant, it meant a complete switch from working with your, well, I suppose, behind the desk to working with your hands on patients. And I felt at the start, you know, that I wouldn't have to take home the work and struggle at home with all these financial statements and so forth. That you couldn't take the patient home.
Gotcha.
Because you couldn't stuff them into a briefcase. But I was very wrong in one respect, because absolutely you couldn't take the patient home, but you took the worry of the treatment that you provided to patients that day, and you were worried just in case things went wrong or didn't work out the way they were intended. And indeed, you know, maybe the patient had a very bad night, either from bleeding or from pain. And so in many ways, you were kind of worried about what would meet you the next morning when you went into the surgery. So that was something that I had anticipated. There was another contrast as well, Siobhan, which I think really is important. When I went to Queen's as an 18-year-old, I had the fullest of student experiences. That's just the way it was. And that time there was all about missing lectures and cramming before exams. I seem to have spent my time catching up. I was more involved in football and the whole student experience and club societies, all of that stuff. It came first. That was a really good student experience. 12 years later, when I started the course in dentistry at Trinity, it was more of an academic experience. Why? Because of the responsibilities. You couldn't afford to fail. You had to be absolutely certain there was no hiccups or setbacks and resets and all of that sort of stuff. And so I was very lucky to have that mix in those two universities, one of a really good student experience and later, 12 years later, of a really good academic experience. But of course, the ideal thing is that you have both at the one time. And that, I think, is what DCU certainly prides itself in, is that it provides a first-class student experience and a first-class academic experience. And that's one of the things I really admire about university. Of course, these are different times. And,
yes.
You know, way back then, things, you know, we were less up to speed. We were more like, as students, we were more on our own. I mean, the whole health and welfare and well-being and safety and all that, these were things I didn't understand. I didn't come across any of those things when I was at Queen's. Just applied your own furrow, really.
So tell me a bit about more that obviously you did study for 5 years in dentistry, and then obviously you had to, did you go into a practice with somebody else? So how did you build out your career then in dentistry?
I came north to work in a practice in Bessbrook in County Armagh with a dentist who had worked as a sole practitioner originally from Bray. So I joined him early in 1985, and we got on really well together. It was a practice that he had worked as a sole practitioner, as I said, but had a huge potential. And after 6 months, we formed a partnership, and they opened up at another location in Cross McLean in South Armagh. Everybody knows of Cross McLean. There had been no dentist there, and we were the first ones to move into Cross McLean. And so we had this two-location practice, and eventually we ended up with a fully computerized practice, and we had three other dentists working for us. So we had a five-dentist practice with all the support and so forth, fully computerized and all of that. So, and in that regard, the accountancy business experience came in very, very useful. And I often think that many of these healthcare professions and professionals, when they come out, do sort of disadvantage, because many of them end up running their own businesses, but they don't have any business experience. And I often think that maybe this is changing a little bit. I'm not fully up to speed, but certainly my experience has been that, you know, in terms of running a business, which, in other words, to provide the best medical service, the best healthcare service or dental service, you really have to be a very effective and efficient and professional business. And for many of these professionals, they aren't given the skills during their training at university.
So brings us on to, you know, you're working away in the dentistry. At what stage then, you know, how did that hold your life of your professional life, and then the decision around your Mary deciding, well, you know, I'm going to run for president. Like, how do those conversations go at home? You know, because they're big. Like, I mean, you already had the big career decision around going back into full-time education, not bringing in a weekly wage, you know, even having that conversation, and then Mary then having the conversation, obviously jointly you're discussing it out, I'm sure it happened over many days, many hours, whatever, and trashing out all the variations on the theme of the impact of your decision to go into dentistry, and then later on her decision then to move into to run for election for president, the president of Ireland?
Well, first of all, I mean, when I went back to study dentistry, I gave up a good job. I had a company car and all the perks that go with a good job. And so that all disappeared.
First, sorry to interrupt you, but apart from your family, like, did people around you, like, did their jaws drop that you were doing this?
Oh,
I'm just thinking it through now myself. I said, if I was to make an announcement yet again, I was going to change to careers, I think everyone would probably like stage an intervention or something. But anyway, tell me a little bit more about that.
Nobody could understand it, Siobhan, quite bluntly. I mean, why would you do such a thing? Like, why would you want to do that? That is, I mean, my mother was still alive at that time. She died roughly a year after I started dentistry, and she couldn't understand. What do you want to be a dentist? Like, what? Have you taken leave of your senses? That invariably was the response. That's the first thing. But if you have a strong conviction that you're doing the right thing and you're following instinct, I mean, that brings us very much to, you know, look on the way that there is so much pushback when you're following your instinct. A lot of people feel that they should do things and go certain directions. That is their instinct. Mm. And yet there can be so much pushback from all kinds of people, from family and the wider circle of friends. And very often that instinct is smothered. It is not expressed. And there's many examples of that. I've seen many examples of that at work. So I think the first thing is, despite the reaction, despite the pushback, if you're convinced that you're doing the right thing and there's a strong conviction around it, you just have to do it simply, despite what. And of course, that will put extra pressure on, because I mentioned earlier about, you know, setting yourself up to be tested again. What if you fail that test? You look stupid in terms of, in the eyes of family and close friends. What did you do? So it requires a huge degree of self-confidence and conviction that you're absolutely doing the right thing. It also brings me back to that academic experience. You could take a chance in not getting through this. You couldn't take a chance in failing. And that's why the academic experience was what I really experienced over and above the student experience when I was back in dentistry. But to go back to the beginning of that time, I mean, that put an excessive burden, if you like, on Mary, but she became the sole wage earner and responsible for all of that. And I had stepped back. Now, I have to say that once it was mentioned to her, I remember it was in May of 1980, we were having a chat, and this is what I suggested to her, and she was absolutely 100% supportive. I mean, if I hadn't have done it, she would have been disappointed, to be quite honest with you. That's how supportive that she was. Within 2 weeks, I had applied to the dental hospital, and shortly after that, I was called for an interview, which I went to. It was successful. I was offered a place, would you believe, for the following September-ish. So within 3 to 4 months from thinking about a change, I was actually going into for the first time, into an anatomy lecture, would you believe, in Trinity. Now, the question always is, if that offer had been not for that September, but for the following September, and I had 16, 17 months to chew this thing over in my mind, would I have honoured the invitation?
And a baby would have arrived by then, maybe, as well.
So that's the thing. Mm. And indeed, I mean, if I had gone, you know, at that stage, which I wouldn't even have thought of, to someone like yourself, Siobhan, as a careers consultant, and said, what in the name of God do you think I should do here? That would probably be, well, yeah, nuts, are you giving up all of that, and you at 30 years of age, and, you know.
Wouldn't have said that to you.
Wouldn't have taken the board out of you. I worked then for those 13 years as a dentist in both those places. That was a very successful practice, and the investment in terms of time was fully recouped, and it was a very successful practice. And then just to go on to the next stage. When Mary Robinson decided not to seek a second term, and in fact stood down for the hours early way back in 1997, Some friends suggested that Mary might be a suitable candidate to stand to succeed Mary Robinson. And, you know, I immediately embraced that. I took that on board and I encouraged her and I tried to persuade her. Her initial reaction was, well, now I'm not going to self-promote here. And the second thing is that if you remember, I don't know if you remember or not, Siobhan, but John Hume's name was mentioned as well as a prospective candidate. And that went on for a long time. He didn't indicate until very late on that he wasn't going to go forward. And until that time, if he had decided to let his name go forward, she would not have stood against him. That's a fact. So
I don't know that anyone would have stood against him, I'll be honest with you.
That's just the regard in which she held him. So, but I assume, took a punt on this, if you like, with some friends. We said, but look, we have to prepare on the basis that he's not going to go. So what I did then with a whole circle of friends, we set a network up roughly from March, April of 1997. I spent more time promoting Mary's name than actually practicing dentistry, would you believe, during those months leading into the summer of 1997. And I got very actively involved in persuading her that you really have to do this. You know, you really have to prepare and you really have to take this on. Because we all felt that she was absolutely the right person at the right time and eminently qualified. And for me, it, you know, and eventually she was elected. But the reason I was so supportive was looking back on growing up in Northern Ireland in a very difficult and a very energy-sapping time for a Catholic living in a loyalist and Protestant stronghold in East Belfast, where we were excluded from community. In fact, we were disconnected from our neighbours. I didn't know even what the word community meant until much later in life. We were loners in our own community. We were regarded second class, marginalised. We were regarded as disloyal or traitors. We were kind of a nuisance there. We didn't have access to equality, equal opportunity. There was no degree of tolerance. And I often look down across the border to the Republic to see my natural hinterland where there was tolerance, there was equal opportunity, there was equality, but there was also importantly the freedom, if you like, to express my nationalism and my Irishness, which was denied to me in Northern Ireland. In fact, the only route to keeping that alive in Northern Ireland, the only way of keeping that alive was through the GAA. It was the handrail, if you like, through all those difficult years growing up in Belfast, that allowed me to stay connected with my Irishness and my nationalism. And GAA has always been a huge part of both of our lives. So when the opportunity arose that in terms of the possibility that she would stand and be elected, I mean, I just went for that 110%. For me, it was absolutely not a sacrifice. I gave up nothing. I just willed that it would happen because it would give us, and it's subsequently turned out to be the case, an opportunity to work to try to make things a little bit different for the next generation, our children.
So
growing up in Northern Ireland, the circumstances in which we grew up.
So I'm trying to tap into what that sense is. You know, what I'm hearing, Martin, you know, feel free to contradict me, is that your values in life superseded, you know, any immediate career goals that you might have had with dentistry at that time. You saw a much, much bigger picture for you and your family by moving along, you know, without doubt, on that journey with Mary to get elected anyway, and then whatever would happen after that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all rooted in the context of growing up as a member of a minority Catholic family in Belfast, and the impact of that on me as a personal legacy of that, and just the unhappiness of. I remember we lost our home twice. In Belfast, we lost it twice. We were put out. Me had a similar experience, our family, and they lost their home. And it was a very difficult time. And, you know, as we get older, very often we kind of go back into our childhood and we relive the memories of all the firsts of that time. And we get comfort and solace from that, you know, reliving the first football game, reliving all those things. But I can do that, but the experience of the solace and the comfort is diminished and undermined by just the naked sectarianism, the fear, the discrimination. And, you know, it's hard to believe this, but at 20, when we lost our home for the first time, I decided that, you know something, I'm just going to begin my life as if this is the first day. And I did that. And I rarely looked back over those first 20 years. And then you fast forward to the time, about 20 odd years later, Mary is elected president, and eventually we begin to roll out the theme of her presidency, building bridges. And for those two words to mean more than just words, it meant we had to reach out to those whom we would not be expected in any circumstances to reach out to. Because if you reach out to those who share the same history, tradition, politics, religion, ambitions for the future, well, you know, that's easy. They are the same, you know, there's no big deal in that. But to do it for those who are diametrically opposed to you in all of those things is a big deal. And I remember when I first met with the loyalist paramilitary leaders whom we reckoned were the most extreme in terms of who we had to reach out to in terms of role position. I remember, and it struck me like a thunderbolt, when we were sitting and talking around the table, that the greatest asset that I could bring to that table, to that discussion, was the fact that I'd, of those first 20 years, the fact that I'd grown up among them, among their people, in their area. I knew every street, pub, club, snooker room, school, shop. I could understand their sense of humour, and I could understand their actions. And what that did was, it conspired to a great street credibility, which we were able to bring to that engagement that resulted in building up this really strong relationship between the R's, if you like, and the and loyalist paramilitaries. And indeed, those relationships are such to be effective. And this is something that I feel very strongly about. If you build a genuine relationship through which you can influence people and add to, say, in this case, peace and reconciliation, those relationships cannot be built just for a time or for a particular purpose. They have to be built on the basis that they will be lifelong, that they will sustain way beyond the time that, you know, that they are, that you make the most of them. And so I'm delighted to say that some of my closest friends to this day are loyalist parliamentary leaders. And that shows just how important that kind of deep, sustainable relationship is, and the impact of it and the opportunity it gives you to influence. I remember, Siobhan, that, I mean, you think of the higher value here in terms of giving up stuff for something a bit bigger. I remember the very first meeting with the loyalist parliamentary leaders where we were trying to figure out what we could do. And I remember saying to them, do you know, if on my deathbed my children would say to me, look, thanks for doing something, contributing to something that has allowed us to grow up in circumstances different from the circumstances that you experienced as a young person growing up in Belfast in the 50s. If they can say that to me, it will vindicate my life. It will mean more to me than all the material and worldly achievements. And so I said to those guys, what do you want for your children? And they kind of said, well, the same. And we agreed that we could not do that on our own for our own children, but perhaps, maybe, we could do it together for all of our children. And so we agreed to try this, and we agreed to set out on a journey to do that, whilst accepting that we didn't know where that journey would take us to, but in the firm belief that no matter where it took us to, it would be to a better place than the place we were starting out from. And that was the cornerstone of that engagement. Another important point.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say that I was gobsmacked at the response to reaching out. In life, I think, and I've seen this so many times and I've experienced this so many times, the hardest part in doing something new, in a new initiative, beginning a new relationship, is the first step. The first step is really, really difficult. And the difficulty is that is of the fear of being rebuffed, the fear of offending or being offended. And so we held back. And I personally held back. Should I shouldn't, should I, or should I? If I reach out, I could make matters worse. There could be the prospect of reputational damage. And you're kind of about to make the move and you hold back. And then suddenly you make the move. And the generosity of the response from those loudest paramilitary leaders really, it's to some extent, made me feel guilty, because I realized, my God, what if you had the courage to do this earlier, to make that step a year ago, to have contributed to maybe moving things a little bit faster in terms of consolidating peace, in terms of moving more towards reconciliation. And I think that's a lesson really for so many of us, you know, never be afraid of the first step. Always take the first step. It is the most difficult one. Whatever you're trying to do, it is the most difficult one. But, you know, just take it.
Just thinking about what you've been saying there, Martin, and like you did, obviously, you know, you've I suppose, illustrated the landscape for you growing up, and that obviously helped you then, you know, A, want to reach into engaging with the loyalist paramilitaries and having a deeper understanding. But like, it sounds like to me that you would have needed, you know, a fair bit of confidence to do that, you know, to say, whistle, you know, like you talked about the first step, but there's confidence that's needed there as well. Can you talk to me a little bit about how confident you were, and maybe you weren't?
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting. I mean, I think that confidence is a big issue for so many people, and particularly for young women, you know, because the whole gender inequality has been rooted and consolidated in our DNA, if you like, right from the beginning of time, right back to ancient societies that were patriarchal in nature and consigned women automatically to subordinate positions, mainly in the home, and men just got on with it. Men got on with shaping the world to their vision and to their way of thinking, and women were very much second class and had no chair at the table at which the decisions were being taken in terms of their future. And that's a big issue, and it's something that, as a society, we really have still to confront, I think, much more seriously than we have confronted. So evidence has shown that because of that, a lot of young women in particular do feel a lack of confidence. But I have found over the years that it's not restricted only to females. And I tell my own story, because I mentioned earlier about growing up in Belfast as a member of that minority Catholic family living in a loyalist or Protestant area. And that constant ambient temperature of fear, intimidation and sectarianism, and you can imagine the impact of that on a young person going through their formative teenage years, the impact on self-confidence, the impact on self-esteem. And so covering the badge on your school blazer, not wearing your school tie except when in school, anything to avoid being noticed. That was the nature of everyday life for me during those 18 or so first years. And the legacy of that, or one of the legacies of that, Siobhan, is a natural instinct to avoid the front row in so many situations, so many engagements, and to actually seek out the anonymity of the back row. So I ended up with a fairly battered confidence at the end of those formative years that I've had to deal with. And to some extent, in situations, I still struggle with that whole issue of confidence. And then, on the other hand, I had the finest of educations. And therein lies a contradiction, because you think that a good education will result in good confidence, but that's not always the case, because of the way that appearances can be very, very deceptive. And I'm not the only one who's had a good education and who feels that kind of lack of confidence. And it's not, as I said, not only restricted to women, but it's also strict to men too. And it is also intergenerational, because we can all think of situations, and I've been in these situations, where as the youngest recruit to a team sitting around the table, and the director or the manager or the boss or the partner is going around asking for opinions and views on the status of whatever particular project is in play. And that young person's fear of looking foolish when his or her turn comes, not knowing what to say, and the palpitations and the knot in the pit of the stomach, the sweaty hands, palms and the dry mouth. We have all had experience of that. And it's intergenerational in the sense that I've talked to so many seasoned people, if you like, both men and women, well on in their years, who feel exactly the same, say, first time before an Oireachtas committee, maybe being cross-examined in court, a difficult TV or radio interview, or maybe joining a board for the first time, aware that the people who are already on that board are high-profile, awesome reputations. So this is something that's intergenerational, because confidence ebbs and flows as you go through life.